Today on Maine Calling, the legacy of Governor Ken Curtis. 60 years ago, a 35-year-old candidate defeated a much more experienced politician and became governor of Maine. Ken Curtis went on to serve two terms as governor and instituted reforms that fundamentally changed Maine government and the state. Curtis streamlined state government, created the UMaine system, and introduced a broad-based income tax. A new biography by journalist and author Douglas Rooks explores Curtis's life and impact. It's titled Transformational: Ken Curtis, Maine's Reform Governor. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Doug Rooks is our guest today on Maine Calling. We will learn about Curtis's story, what inspired a farm boy from Leeds to pursue a singular vision for Maine, and how did he do it? Maine Calling is just ahead.
Support for Maine Calling comes from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure throughout Maine, now open in Bangor, Waterville, and Augusta. And Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org. And Bangor Savings Bank, committed to helping northern New England communities thrive. You matter more. Bangor.com.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Ken Curtis was elected governor of Maine almost 60 years ago. Today, we look back at the lasting impact he had on the state. My guest for the hour, Douglas Rooks, he is a journalist and author of four books, including his latest, Transformational, Maine's Reform Governor. It is a biography of Ken Curtis. We invite you to join the conversation. Share your comments and questions. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Doug, welcome back to Maine Calling, and congratulations on the book.
Well, thank you. It's really good to be back. I love radio. I really do. Well, I'm a print guy, but I love radio.
Well, let's start. Ken Curtis was governor of Maine from 1967 to 1965. Elected in 1966, 60 years ago. He is still very much alive at age 95. So were you able to interview him for the book? And if so, what was that like?
Well, it was a very interesting experience because the interviews, most of them I did with Ken were in 2019. And then something called the pandemic came along and really uprooted me from the book. It was really impossible to do the kind of interviews I needed to do, you know, by Zoom. I just couldn't do it. So I suspended activity on this book, wrote another book, and then came back to it. And 7 years later, it's finally in print. So Governor Curtis is a very interesting interview, very different than George Mitchell, who was my first book subject. Ken is a very warm person, very open. You know, he has, I think, infinite patience for journalists. I was startled when I read Bill Caldwell, a long ago columnist for the Press Herald, got 3 hour blocks with Curtis. It's like, I mean, we can't even get 5 minutes with a politician these days, 3 hours. So he's a very patient guy. And I think the key facts and interpretations that I made came out very slowly over time because it takes a lot of time. I mean, the transcripts of those interviews run to hundreds of pages, but you can find what you want, you know, when you really drill down there. It's a very different kind of thing from a person, well, George Mitchell, a super lawyer, who spoke very precisely in full sentences. And when he was done, you were done. You know, I didn't even usually ask follow-ups with Mitchell. And invited follow-up questions. And that's why it's a whole world that that you can inhabit in the book if I did a good job on it.
Well, let's talk about his childhood. He grew up on a farm in Leeds, and he knew very early on that he did not want to be a farmer. Why not?
Yes. Well, he was the fifth generation of Curtises on that farm. And you can imagine, he grew up in the Great Depression and then World War II. Farming was played out. I mean, people were literally leaving the land in desperation, and he didn't want to do that. His parents were able to live on the farm most of the rest of their lives, but he he wanted something else. So he got out, and he said, "In you know, this is an approximate of the quote." He said, "You know, when you become restless, you want to take political action." And from a very early age, I think really high school, he was very focused on a political career.
And I'm so interested. It's so interesting that even as a teenager, he figured out that his path to a different life was education. And yes. He took a pretty dramatic step to get that better education.
He did. You know, he had finished grammar school, as they called it then, in Leeds, eighth grade. And then he had a choice of going to Turner or Monmouth. That's where all his classmates went. He decided to go to Coney High School in Augusta, the big city, when you're from a farm kid. And that was a difficult experience from the beginning, but the principal took him under his wing and helped him. And he achieved the political triumph of becoming president of Chisel Whizzle, which is a variety show that is a long-standing tradition at Coney. It's a real honorary position. And I joked a little bit, but it's true. It was his first elective office.
Well, and what was so interesting to me about that, Doug, is that, well, there are several things, but that he had to hitchhike home every day after school. I mean, he was really committed to going to a different high school that could offer him more.
He was a country boy who realized that his future lay in the cities. And it's not any surprise that he ended up fairly quickly on as early in his career in Portland, because he knew that was where he had to make good if he was going to succeed in politics.
All right. So he went off to Maine Maritime Academy, did not follow the traditional path of a merchant mariner or not for long, or the traditional path into law school. I mean, we've got a lot of ground to cover, but very quickly, tell me how Ken Curtis goes from Coney High School to becoming a lawyer in Portland.
Well, he went to Maine Maritime chiefly because it was free tuition. He probably could not have gone to college at the time, even though tuition rates look incredibly low to us. They weren't to the people who were trying to get into college. So he went to Maine Maritime and he became a Navy man. I didn't realize the importance of that aspect to his career. And of course, he ended his career as the president of Maine Maritime Academy many years later. So Maine Maritime was logical, and then he did serve a tour, as they called it, that in the Merchant Marine. I think it was 7 or 8 months. Anyway, he made a ton of money, which he got paid on the dock in Baltimore when he got off. I love these details, so different than today. And so he had a bunch of money, and he went back to Portland. He married Polly Curtis 5 years. Now Polly Curtis, who was 5 years younger than he was, and they worked to put him through law school together. He worked at Sears. She worked in various different places in the billing departments, and they worked their way up. Graduating from law school was the first step, and then getting involved in politics was very important, and he did that early on.
His first political campaign was for Congress. He ran for the first congressional district seat, and he lost, but that loss opened some doors for him.
It sure did. Well, it was a very close election because at the time, this is a big theme in the book, there was this thing called the big box where you just checked a box on the ballot and you voted for all the Democrats or all the Republicans. It was a really big deal. And in 1964, Barry Goldwater was a very unpopular Republican in Maine, and Johnson got a huge vote in Maine, and other Democrats also were lifted up by that. We used to call them coattails. And it almost launched him to victory. But he says, anyway, that he didn't really want to win the congressional seat. He just wanted to become better known so he could run for governor. And in any case, that's exactly what happened.
He was just 35 years old when he ran for governor. He'd been Maine Secretary of State for 2 years.
2 years.
I'm thinking 2 years. About that, Doug. 35 years old. That's some chutzpah. How did he win?
Well, he won because he represented change, and the country and Maine were ready for change. You have to realize that, well, Ed Muskie had been elected governor 12 years earlier, 1954, in a shocking upset, that the Democrats were still very much in the minority. So the only way a Democrat could win was getting a ton of Republican votes. I mean, we had a 6-to-1 registration advantage for Republicans. And Ken did that because he was very clever. He had worked a federal job appointed by the Kennedy administration, which got him traveling around the state, talking to businessmen everywhere. So he was very well embedded in the rural culture of Maine. Of course, he came from it. So he was persuasive as a candidate in a way that most Democrats of the day, who were mostly Franco-Americans, were not. And yeah, I mean, he was on a rising tide, but I would also point out 66 was a terrible year for Democrats nationally. They lost a ton of seats in Congress, but he beat an incumbent governor the last time that has happened in Maine.
He had something called the Maine Action Plan. I
He
understand when
did.
he was campaigning, I learned from your book, people referred to him as the man with a plan, and it ended up
He
being
did.
the blueprint for his administration. Doug, why don't you tell us some of the highlights of that plan? And I'm also just curious of where he came up with that. Again, 35 years old, how did he get all these ideas, and how are they so fully fleshed out?
Well, it does show you what a small universe Democratic politics was back then. There were two architects of the Maine Action Plan. I should say first, the reason he did it was political. He was 35 years old, and a lot of people thought he was way too young to be governor. You know, we have the same problem today. But so he decided to get to appear more serious, have this plan that would convince people like college professors and, you know, educated voters that he was serious, and he had a better plan than the Republicans, who frankly had no plan. So the Maine Action Plan came out piecemeal at the end, but the important part is how it was created. It was created by his brain trust, which existed of George Mitchell, the party chair of the day, a very important position who worked directly with the candidates at that time. It's a very small universe, as I said. George Mitchell was important, and as was Alan Pease, who was a professor at Gorham State College, who was eventually his chief of staff, and Curtis set his partner as governor. I mean, it was a really important thing. So they largely put this together with help from many other people writing these things about housing and environment and conservation and economic development. But the first, longest, and most important section is about education. And that's what he was about. He was the education governor, even though he never claimed that title himself. He completely revamped the K-12 system. They created the University of Maine system. Everything was on a much higher plane, much better funded, and the public loved it at the time. Education was very popular as a political issue back then. And Curtis, I think, did more than anyone else to create that. So he said later it was a blueprint for the entire administration, and in many ways it was. Not everything is in the plan, but you can see how it was, he could use it for 8 years. The reorganization of government, which he advocated, the cabinet, which did not exist at the time, that was created. It took the entire second term to do it. So it was an 8-year plan, and it was not done on that basis, but it really worked. And I think it's an important example of what policy and ideas can do to buttress a campaign, not replace the candidate, but to make the candidate more substantial, more convincing to people who maybe ideologically would not be inclined to vote for that person.
Well, let me ask you this. You said that education was a very popular topic, a very popular reform to campaign on. Was this, do you believe, purely political, or do you believe that Ken Curtis emphasized education because, as a farm boy from Leeds, he was not given the same opportunities that others were, and that he wanted to change that?
That is absolutely the case. You know, he really believed in public education. That was very important to him. I mean, he said, you know, we have great private colleges in Maine, but if the bulk of Maine people who want to be educated at the college level are going to get an education, they have to do it through the public university. And he was right. I mean, it was a huge influx of people. But you remember the baby boom, people have said it's like the pig in the python or the thing going through the garden hose. The baby boom was such an enormous demographic shift that Maine was building schools like at an incredible rate. You know, we're not building them at the moment. That's, I think, a problem. But back then, new schools were opening half a dozen every single year. And parents believed this. They wanted their kids to become more educated. The high school dropout rate was 50% back then. That has changed enormously since then. And yeah, probably more kids could go to college, and maybe we should support more kids going to college. But for Ken, that was a powerful force that I think he was able to harness. It was not just him. The Republican legislatures he served with were instrumental in particularly getting the university system up and running.
Yeah, and you mentioned the high school dropout rate, Doug. One of the many things that's so interesting about your book is how different, learning how different Maine was back then. And one of those things is not just what the high school dropout rate was, but how Maine really lagged New England in college graduates. And that was very
Yes.
important to Ken Curtis to change.
Yeah, I mean, it still does a little bit, but that's because the rest of New England is so well educated. I mean, Massachusetts has, most people think, the best public school system in the country. You know, we got tough competition here, but Maine has absolutely progressed since then in terms of opportunity for education and really, well, certainly funding. We're doing very well.
These days, we often look at politicians and expect the first 100 days to be really dramatic. And it's something that is written about and marked. But that wasn't the case back then. And Ken Curtis really surprised some people by how he got right down to business when he was elected governor, right? Tell me what it was like.
Well, he did, but his experience was very different. I mean, FDR, Lyndon Johnson, people like that had an enormous Democratic Congress behind them. That was not what Curtis encountered at all. In fact, the first year was a real learning experience for both the legislature and Curtis, because he got in, and of course, he wanted to do a lot of new stuff. The Republicans were not interested. They continued to pass budget bills that he didn't like. It was a lot of conflict. In fact, the session ended in complete acrimony when he vetoed the budget, and they had to come back in July. Now, for people who remember the state shutdown of 1991, the attorney general of the day, Jim Irwin, who later ran against Curtis for his reelection, ruled that although the state shouldn't make any big investments, they didn't have to shut down. It was a very different thing. But literally, the state did not have a budget, and then they finally agreed on a budget. And then they went back after that, and they were much more cooperative because the people of the state, as represented for the many editorial writers that then existed, said, "Shame on both of you. You know, this is not what we need from government." And they actually changed. They changed. They learned how to cooperate. And that's what he was able to accomplish for the last 7 years of his administration. But it was a very rocky start. There's no question.
Well, I want to talk about some of the things he accomplished. You'd mentioned something about the UMaine system and the streamlining of government, but we're going to talk a little bit more in depth about those and some other changes when we come back. We're speaking with Doug Rooks. His new biography is about Governor Ken Curtis. What are your comments or questions? Our phone number 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We're learning why Ken Curtis is considered Maine's reform governor, including how he implemented Maine's income tax and created the University of Maine system. With me today, Doug Rooks, editor, columnist, and reporter, and just finished a new biography of Ken Curtis called Transformational: Ken Curtis, Maine's Reform Governor. We invite you to join the conversation. Send us a brief email. Talk@mainpublic.org. Comment on Facebook or Instagram or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. We'll get to listener calls and emails in just a couple minutes, but Doug, we want to talk about some of these accomplishments. You mentioned very briefly that Ken Curtis instituted a cabinet. Well, what was there before there was a cabinet?
Well, I would say it was a bit of a mess because new state agencies were being created throughout the 50s and 60s. There was a real demand for states to do more. The federal government was doing too much in many people's estimation, and states started to have real governments for the first time. So, but there were about 100 and some different estimates, somewhere between 150 and 200 separate independent agencies, including the big guys like the Highway Commission of the day, now DOT, Health and Human Services. They were all separate and not necessarily under the control of the governor. So it was not a great job, to be quite honest, for a reforming governor who wanted to do so much. So they had to create this cabinet structure. And today we have a very powerful executive. You know, all of the cabinet commissioners are subject to hiring and firing by the governor whenever the governor wants to do that. That was not the case back then. So everyone recognized that this needed to be done. The Republicans, as a party of efficiency and saving money and that sort of stuff, were very interested in that program. I think the Democrats, or most of them, were more interested in getting the income tax. But so Ken was able to do both, though, because he knew how to make deals across the aisle. So yeah, the current structure of state government is almost entirely his and the Republican legislature's creation.
Okay, and so yeah, let me ask you that question. We said Maine did not have an income tax before Ken Curtis, and as you mentioned, he did not have a Democratic legislature. And we know that most Republican politicians do not like the income tax. How did that happen?
It's a tremendously complicated story, which is a whole chapter in the book. But to sum up, the biggest obstacle for Ken in some ways was psychological, because his predecessor Ed Muskie had engineered an increase in the sales tax, because that's what Republicans like. As we know, sales taxes are more regressive, meaning they bear more heavily on ordinary working people. Income taxes can be, and this one definitely was, progressive, meaning wealthy people pay at a higher rate, so they contribute more to the kitty. And Muskie absolutely told Ken, do not do this. If you do it, and even if you succeed, you'll never get reelected. And it was almost true. He barely was reelected. The income tax turned out to be actually quite popular because it shifted a lot of spending, even though the state was spending more, towns, particularly at the school level, property taxes went down. People really liked that. And they didn't mind, people who had wealth paying through the income tax. So it was very popular, but getting it done was incredible because the Democrats were not united either. Many of the Democrats represented Franco-American mill town districts, and they knew that their constituents hated the idea of any new tax, so they were against it. And he had to get 101 votes in the House. It just seems absolutely impossible. But over the entire session, they got enough votes or close to it. And there's a very funny story about a representative from Old Orchard Beach named Nick Danton, who was the 101st vote. And here's the amazing part of it to me is when that vote was taken and the bill had been enacted by two-thirds in both houses, the chamber broke out into wild cheering and applause. Can you imagine that about a tax bill today? I certainly can't.
No. And the not to oversimplify it, but the reason for the income tax was to boost education and infrastructure
It really
spending.
was. Yeah, the Republicans wanted to do it entirely through the sales tax. So had they prevailed, we might have a 8, 9, or 10% sales tax today if we had no income tax. Washington State is a little like that, whereas Oregon, their neighbor, has only an income tax. It's a fascinating contrast in state policies. But anyway, Maine has the income tax. It is the mainstay of the state budget now. And it's taken on water over the years, but it's still the mainstay of state taxation, whether people like it or not.
The University of Maine system formed under Ken Curtis. What was there before, and why was there an impetus to change? And I understand that this was very unpopular, that the entire faculty voted against it or voiced their opposition
Well,
to it.
yeah, the university system vote was complex because certain camp. Okay, you asked what it was like. What it was like was we had the University of Maine, which was the primary 4-year degree granting institution in the state, plus all the graduate programs. We had five teachers' colleges, including Gorham, and then the new Portland campus, which was very small and just getting started at those days. I mean, all the students and most of the faculty were still in Gorham. And we had the fledgling University of Maine, I'm sorry, University of Maine at Augusta, which had just been created in 1966 and was meeting in an office building. So, we had a very vestigial system that needed to be put together. The opposition was from the Farmington campus, apparently, because it turned out that the way it would work is it would be more expensive for kids that attended Farmington to go to the University of Maine. I think it was a kind of an internecine battle. Overall, I'd say the public was probably not as involved, but there were several key Republican legislators. Probably the most important was a wonderful guy named Harry Richardson, who wrote the income tax bill and also was one of the chief sponsors of the university bill as well. So Ken worked throughout his tenure with prominent Republicans, one of whose name we still know is Solon Millett, who was a freshman legislator, a Republican who sponsored the education reform bill, which transformed K through 12 education. So it was a very interesting dance that took place The university was not popular at the start. Several bond issues for it were turned down in the early going, and I'm not sure we've entirely resolved that problem. Universities are seen as elitist institutions; they always have been, and there's a tension between that and the ordinary voters, some of which do not see much purpose in having a public university. It's not like we've totally overcome the problem, but the important thing is we have a system now.
So many more important legacies, the expansion of public lands, including the Allegash Wilderness Waterway and Rangeley Lake State Park. As you mentioned, the creation of the SADs, the Maine Human Rights Act. But Doug, I want to ask you about something very personal, which is many people have heard about Camp Susan Curtis. Thousands of people have attended Camp Susan Curtis. It's named for Governor Curtis's daughter. Tell me about Susan Curtis. And for those listeners who are too young to remember, what happened to her and to his other daughter?
Well, they had cystic fibrosis. They were born with it, as it's a genetic condition, and it was incredibly tragic. Susan Curtis, for whom the camp was named later, was 11 years old when she died in the middle of the 1970 re-election campaign. It was just a stunning blow. We do wonder how some people go on, and Ken did, and he won re-election, but it's terrible. And his other daughter, Angela, or Angel, as she was known, she was just a delight. She was just one of the when they ran around the Blaine house, it was like the kids ran the place. I mean, we've never had anything like that since then. It was really like John Kennedy and Jacqueline in the White House, I think, in many ways, a similar time period too. Anyway, people loved the Curtis daughters, and they both died. Angel survived into her 30s and married and had a life. And that was partly because she was identified as at birth as having cystic fibrosis. Susan, unfortunately, was not identified until she was age two, and she died very young. That disease is almost entirely curable now. It would not happen today, but it was a great family tragedy. And when he left office with his friends, they decided to create a memorial, and that is Camp Susan Curtis, which is a wonderful place up in Stoneham on the lake. And they have four sessions every summer of 10 days, and kids who would not be able to afford to go to camp elsewhere go there. And it's apparently a life-changing experience for many of them. So it's a wonderful legacy that came out of tragedy.
We'll go to Mike, who's calling from Tennant's Harbor. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. How you be?
I'm wonderful. How are you, Mike?
I'm very well. I had the distinct pleasure shortly after I joined Masonry to meet Ken Curtis, and he very, very soon became a mentor and a really good friend. He was one of the most well-spoken, introspective people that I've ever had the pleasure to meet. He was just a joy to be around, and it didn't matter what you thought about any given thing or what your status was, he could talk to you and he could get to your level and get people that were of very opposing views to at least listen and be reasonable and be agreeable. They could disagree, but they were agreeable, and he just had a magic with people that very, very few people have. And I just consider myself so fortunate that he accepted me as a friend.
Mike, thank you for calling. Doug.
Yeah, he had that quality. And the phrase that we know is how to disagree without being disagreeable. And he absolutely had it. It was remarkable. He could take very unpopular positions with the majority of the public, but nobody held it against him. And one of the reasons he got elected is although people did think they hated the income tax before it was actually instituted, but they were willing to vote for him anyway because he was true to his belief. He was honest, very above board. He never dodged a question. And those strengths of character, I think, is what your listener is talking about. He was really willing to engage with anyone, listen carefully, and respond civilly. And he got angry, like a lot of people, but you didn't see that in any of his public appearances. He was very composed always. And, I think people saw him as the governor of all the people.
Mike, thanks for calling in. We will go to Portland and Jamie. Hi, Jamie, go ahead.
Oh, hey, Jennifer. So I'm going to switch out a little bit because I was going to talk about or ask about the current political climate, so to speak. But let's just leave that alone because I know your interview with him was back in 2019. So do you think his feeling for the fact that everyone's statements now live in real time, that, you know, maybe those longer interviews of the past were part of saying, well, you know, this is a chance to check in and people are going to drift away. You know, when you go on the record now, it's just back at you. And so I didn't know if he had a sense of, at the time, you know, how current and present everything always is now and how politicians are probably afraid of that or not afraid, but they're concerned about, saying something that's going to be stuck with them for the rest of their career. So I'll leave it there. Thanks.
I think you're right. You're right on it there. Politics is very different now. The internet has really changed everything. I mean, we thought that political advertising on television was a big deal back in the 70s and 80s. And today it's been eclipsed by online stuff. It's very difficult. I mean, Ken Curtis could not operate the way he did in today's environment. I think that's true. It's very hard to even get out of the starting blocks before people are attacking you. It's a very difficult problem, which I don't think anyone pretends to have the solution to. But what I think we're looking at is we can get things from the past that do work, they still work, and try to practice some of them. I wish we could solve this problem, but I don't think we can, except to keep on and try to figure out what would create a politics that's a little more civil and a little more bipartisan and a little bit more focused on the interests of the people who sent you there in the first place.
We'll go to Camilla calling from Brunswick. Hi, Camilla, go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I just wanted to talk about what a different climate it was in 1973 and what a personal man he was. I was young in a cabin and was watching my black and white TV about nuclear waste storage in Hanford, Washington, and I wrote him a handwritten letter. He gets right back to me with a whole bunch of typewritten material, and anytime I wanted to call, he would talk to me, you know, and I'm nobody.
Camilla, you would call the State House and ask for the governor, and he would talk to you?
Yep. And,
wow.
And the other thing is, he was really active in, you know, providing the groundwork for federal recognition for the tribes. I know that when everybody was afraid that Ronald Reagan was going to get in next, which he did as a president. And, you know, so people were hurrying up. But he provided the groundwork for a lot of the stuff that's being struggled and worked on today. So he was just a good guy.
Doug.
Yes, he was. And I wanted to point out that that I did interview him quite a bit, not just in 2019, but that was the bulk of my interviews and really, you know, produced the longest transcripts. I mean, he would talk for a couple of hours. This is just my offering on this subject of current politics versus that politics. It's one of my favorite quotes in the book. It's from Saulwin Millett, who just retired in 2024 from the legislature at the age of 86. But as he reminded me the other day, he's not really retired. He is now a county commissioner. So there you go. Public service. But this is my quote. I asked him about what it was like when they were passing all this amazing legislation and today. And this is what he said. I like politics that is talking and not yelling. There's way too much yelling in politics. I think that kind of sums it up.
Camilla, thank you for your call. We are talking about Governor Ken Curtis. Our guest is Doug Rooks. His latest book is called Transformational, Ken Curtis, Maine's Reform Governor. Join our conversation, our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We're learning what it was about former Governor Ken Curtis that set him apart. My guest, author Doug Rooks, whose book, Transformational, describes how Curtis lived and governed. It's a biography of Ken Curtis. Share your comments and questions. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. You can also give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Torbert calling from York. Hi, Torbert. Go ahead.
Good morning, Jennifer and guest. I understand that Governor Curtis was a proponent of public electric power, and that he proposed a power authority that would build a dam on the Allegash River at the Dickey Lincoln. It was called the Dickey Lincoln Dam. I wonder what happened in that situation to change his mind such that the Allegash, thank the maker, is still a free-flowing river.
Okay, Doug, you're right about this whole thing.
Yes, no, this is... It's an amazing thing. Okay, I'm going to refer you to one of his slogans, which was conservation through development. Now, today, this would seem to make no sense, but Curtis passionately believed in this. He was absolutely for complete wilderness protection for the Allegash, which didn't actually happen. There are many more entry points for the Allegash than he would have preferred and were in the original plan for developing the waterway. However, he also had made a huge effort behind building an oil refinery in Machiasport. Long story, it involved the way oil prices were determined at that time, but it was because Maine had the highest petroleum prices in New England and the lowest incomes. It was a real mismatch, and people really struggled to heat their homes, which were all heated by oil in those days. So those are both the polarities you're talking about. The Dickey Lincoln Project was originally proposed earlier and authorized by the Johnson administration in 65 before he became governor. But the purpose of building the dam was to get the power authority. And he was passionately for that. He went toe-to-toe with CMP over this issue. The reading is very bracing because we're still arguing over the same stuff today. But the point was he wanted the power authority because he believed that was the only way to really put a yardstick against the prices that CMP and Bangor Hydro and Maine Public were charging at the time. And, you know, he was probably right. But there is no public power in Maine or in New England. You know, there just isn't. And the climactic battle there was in 1973, where a referendum is proposed. People defeated it. So that was public power. But the Allegash was a lifelong thing for Ken. He gave interviews into the 21st century about his vision for maximum wilderness. And here's the important point. He thought that was the best economic use of it as well, because that's what would be the best for Maine people economically. You build stuff here, you preserve stuff there. That is a vision that, you know, I would love to see us go back to, because I think it's probably the right call. Maine has abundant natural resources that need protection, but it also needs jobs for ordinary people. And traditionally, at least, industry has provided those. And I think we've done better on conservation than development since then. That's just my opinion after looking at the record.
We'll go to George calling from Rockland. Hi, George. Go ahead.
Thank you. And thank you very much for putting on the author of this book that is way overdue. Governor Curtis deserves so much more than people are aware, and even were aware at the time when he was as effective as he was. I want to call in because I crossed paths with Governor Curtis directly and indirectly over four important parts of my career. I'm an architect. I'm 84 years old. I'm mostly retired. But when I was starting out, I worked with several of his associates and assistants, the director of the Housing Authority, the director of Economic Development, and he... Governor Curtis and these people and other people that I worked with in that capacity were all first class, and the people that they hired were all first class. I worked briefly with him and the two and then three lawyers that he founded a firm in Portland, Curtis, Thaxter, Lopez, and Michelow, and they were superb clients to work with. I worked with him indirectly when he was at the Maine Maritime Academy, when I and members of my firm prepared a master plan of the academy, and like we couldn't have had a more constructive relationship, including dealing with many difficult physical and, I would say, political, but with a small p, problems. And then lastly, there was a couple who had inherited the lake that Camp Susan Curtis was founded on from their father, who had founded a camp, and they had approached me to develop the lake, and I said, this is way too important a piece of property. Find someone who can put it to a higher and better use. And if you take a bath on the sale, you're doing a great service to that higher and better use. So I just want to say thank you again for writing this book.
Oh, well, George, thank you so much for calling in, Doug.
Well, you're very welcome. Curtis was very multifaceted, and he believed in the state taking a leading role, not necessarily in accomplishing all this stuff, but in directing and planning it. And the thing I missed the most that was vibrant back in Curtis's day and then for a while after is the state planning office. That was the nerve center, the brains of state government. And frankly, projects, development stuff was much better coordinated back then than we have now, where all agencies seem to be operating pretty much on their own, and much is farmed out to the Public Utilities Commission, which is not really designed to be a development agency. It's a regulatory agency. So yeah, there's some work to be done here to try to get back the sense that the state is willing and able to lead and not necessarily take up all the space, but to have a positive affirmative role in all these major questions, like how do we build renewable energy in Northern Maine? We can't really expect the private sector to just do it. But I think that sense has been lost, and I would love to see it come back, as your listener was talking about.
George, thanks for your call. We'll go to Augusta and John. Hi, John, go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'm of an age, I was just finishing up my college education when Curtis was governor, and I have a vague memory of him going on television one night. I don't remember if it was requested time or just part of a news interview, but I seem to remember him saying, it may cost me my reelection, but here is why we need an income tax. And in looking back at that over the subsequent years, it's become my personal definition of the difference between a politician and a statesman. He was willing to risk his own political career for something he thought was important for the good of the state.
John, thank you. Doug.
I think the caller has said that very well. I mean, he was absolutely willing to risk his career for an idea or a program he believed in. And this was not an isolated instance. One of the ones that kind of blew me away was in 1969, he proposed a gun control bill that was wildly unpopular in Maine. And he did it because that's what the Governors Association, which was then nonpartisan, had asked all states to do in the wake of the assassinations of John Kennedy and Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy. We felt we had to do something, and the federal government did have a law, the Gun Control Act. States were supposed to follow through, but Maine was not really ready to do that. And yet, Ken pushed for that bill. He was very strong about it. And he said, I know most of you disagree with me, but I'm going to do my duty. And he did. And there are other instances of this too. And it's just so striking that this is so different than we expect our politicians to do today, where they're mostly, you know, trying to figure out how to get reelected and basing things on that. He absolutely did not do that.
John, thank you for your call. Here's a Facebook question from Allison Hodgkins at the World Fairs Council. What does Doug Rooks know about a 1972 meeting between Curtis and UN Secretary General U Thant, accompanied by his predecessor, Governor Reed, and the founders of the World Affairs Council of Maine? The meeting was part of an effort to establish an international conference and retreat center on Peaks Island. We have heard a lot about this meeting and seen some printed references, but can't confirm it. Doug, did you talk about this with the governor at all, Governor Curtis?
I did not talk with him about it, but I did find a document that bears on this. And fortunately, because I've got a good index in the book, I was able to find it. So this is the very short reference in the book to exactly what we're talking about here. It says, an even more visionary plan for a United Nations Conference Center on Peaks Island held initial promise. Curtis, Portland Mayor William McVane, whose brother represented ABC at the UN, and other community backers flew to New York to meet with U Thant, the Secretary of General. A national advisory committee was convened, but as an Evening Express editorial observed, we gather Mr. U Thant was courteous but noncommittal, although no doubt he can appreciate the value of such a center to diplomats assigned to the UN, the news media, and world leaders. It was not to be. So yeah, great idea. It didn't happen, but yes, he absolutely. I hadn't heard Governor Reed was there. But anyway, that is in the archives. I can tell you that.
An email from Dick. My father, Richard Morton of Farmington, was on the governor's council during Governor Curtis's administration. It was primarily Republican with some very influential members, such as Bob Porches from Portland. Governor Curtis did not favor the governor's council system and worked hard to do away with it. However, Governor Curtis was very respectful of the council, and my dad, who later became a legislator, always admired Governor Curtis's political skill and creativity.
True. And that is another thing that seems unbelievable today. The Republican Executive Council was Republican because the Republicans controlled the legislature. New Hampshire, I would point out, still has a council, but it's elected by the voters. That's kind of a different thing. This was sort of amplifying the control of the legislature and the executive council, which had to approve all his nominations and contracts. So it was a big stick with which Curtis had to contend. And I think the same thing is with the legislature. Initially, it was very stormy. He proposed a guy, a public power advocate, a wonderful man from Arista County named Elmer Violet, who later ran against Bill Cohen and lost in 1972 for Congress. It's a cool story to follow all these threads through. But Curtis absolutely believed he was the right guy to serve on the PUC, and the council just kept saying no and no and no. And it didn't happen. And he was really pretty furious about that. But he did learn how to work with them, and he very, very skillfully maneuvered his choice as Chief Justice, a very important position, onto Armand Dufresne, the first Franco-American Chief Justice, onto the court by kind of playing the right levers, renominating him and stuff. So yes, I think by the end, they were actually quite cordial. In fact, there's an account of the last council meeting he attended. Then everybody was just very warm and friendly to each other and congratulating and passing some more nominations. So it was a learning curve again for the council and Curtis, but the story ends well.
We just have a couple minutes left, Doug, but I want to ask you something that strikes me after reading your biography of Ken Curtis is that it seems to me in those years he was governor, 1967 to 1965, Maine changed a great deal. One might argue that Governor Curtis dragged the state into the 20th century. Would you agree with that?
Well, you can't drag Mainers anywhere, I don't think. But yes, but leading a charge, inspiring young people. Of course, he was 35 himself, so you had, and you can see this at the national level with John Kennedy. Young people really flocked to his banner, and they went into different places. I was the editor of Maine Times, a great tradition which really covered rural Maine in a way no one ever had before. And we knew about the back to the land movement, people moving, young people moving up to far reaches of Maine simply to get back to the land. But there was a huge influx into urban areas as well of young professionals. And for the first time in a century, Maine really started growing in terms of population. The population increase for the first census after Curtis left office was 13%, outpacing the national average. It's kind of astonishing because we went to a very low growth phase where Maine was barely growing at all. And as we've heard in recent news stories, it's growing again with very much the same kind of demographic, young people moving to Maine. So this is a great opportunity for the next administration, I believe, to capitalize on that, to, you know, create some gains in the way the capabilities of state government. That would be a great outcome for everybody.
We have an email from the Gardner Public Library. Doug Rooks will be at the Gardner Public Library on June 16th at 6:30 p.m. for an author event about his book on Ken Curtis. Doug, is that your only appearance?
No, we have two more. Saturday we'll be in Leeds, Curtis's hometown, with the Leeds Historical Society and the Kennebec Land Trust. He donated the family farm to the Kennebec Land Trust, one of their first acquisitions back in 2003. That is at 7 p.m. And then on Wednesday, we will be at Augusta City Hall with the Kennebec Historical Society, a wonderful organization that has hosted several of my gatherings before. That'll be at City Hall Auditorium at 6:30. So that's the initial round of book events. Be great if people can attend one of them.
Okay, just a few seconds left, but I have to ask you, has Governor Curtis read your biography and have you heard from him?
Not yet, but of course, I have to say the book This is the only hardcover copy in existence that I have on my desk. The rest are coming Wednesday, so he hasn't had time yet, but I'm sure he will read it. I am.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And again, congratulations. Doug Rooks, a journalist and author, his new biography of Ken Curtis is Transformational, Maine's Reform Governor. Our sound engineer today was Sam Tracy. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, tune in to hear about the wide range of performing arts, shows, events, and festivals happening this summer season. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.